Hello and welcome to the latest podcast in our series Living with Diabetes, brought to you by Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. In this edition, a Staying Well special, we're looking at the role of exercise and an active lifestyle in helping to manage diabetes, including the benefits of interval walking training for a better control of type 2 with Dr. Richard Metcalfe.
Interval training, or sometimes called high-intensity interval training, is very simple in terms of all you're doing is alternating sort of periods of what we call a higher-intensity exercise with the periods of lower-intensity exercise within the same exercise session.
And we've been speaking to Patrick Mertz in the United States about the Diabetes Family Connection Challenge to climb 50 peaks in 50 days to help build confidence and optimism within people living with diabetes.
There is an adventurer called Colin O'Grady who set the world record for achieving the highest summit in each of the 50 states. We thought that this could be a challenge that we could replicate and then also involve people from across the United States that were affected by diabetes.
We hear from Dr. Eleanor Kennedy on DRWF's current portfolio of research projects.
DRWF funds a really nice broad portfolio of research. It's not just islet cell transplantation. It funds across the type 1 and the type 2 research portfolio.
And we're also speaking to Shivani Misra with insights from her DRWF-funded research programme, My Diabetes.
The My Diabetes study was really something that I came up with the idea for just before I applied for funding for my PhD from the DRWF. And I was interested in looking for a rare form of diabetes called MODY, which stands for Maturity Onset Diabetes of the Young.
I'm Claire Levy from DRWF, the host of our monthly podcast, Living with Diabetes. This month, we're leading with a Staying Well special looking at the role of exercise and an active lifestyle in helping to manage diabetes. The first story looks at the benefits of interval walking training for better control of type 2. I've been talking to Dr. Richard Metcalfe, an exercise physiologist at Swansea University Research Centre in Applied Sports, Technology, Exercise and Medicine, where he's been looking at the health benefits of exercise, with a primary focus on high-intensity interval training and its effects on cardiorespiratory fitness, carbohydrate metabolism and diabetes.
Interval training, or sometimes called high-intensity interval training, is very simple in terms of all you're doing is alternating sort of periods of what we call a higher-intensity exercise with periods of lower intensity exercise within the same exercise session. So it's those sort of peaks and troughs in the intensity of exercise you're doing. I think the first thing to kind of point out there is that we're saying higher intensity exercise, but that's relative to your own individual baseline level of fitness, shall we say. So if you're talking about an elite athlete, who obviously has a very high level of fitness, then high intensity is going to mean things like fast running and very high intensity cycling. Whereas if you're talking about someone who's maybe a little bit less fit and who hasn't exercised for a long time, then something like brisk walking could be considered high intensity relative to that individual's level of fitness. So there's lots of different ways to perform interval training. The way it's performed can potentially influence the improvements in blood sugar levels that we see for someone with type 2 diabetes. And then interval walking training is a specific type of interval training. And it's potentially a very useful form of interval training for someone with type 2 diabetes because it involves simply alternating periods of sort of slower paced walking with periods of faster paced walking. And walking is obviously a very accessible form of physical activity and exercise for people with type 2 diabetes, and therefore it could potentially be something that could be quite easily integrated into kind of the daily physical activity routines.
So what are the benefits on blood glucose levels, and is there a long-term benefit?
There's a few research studies now showing that if we do a direct comparison of interval walking training with just continuously paced walking. The interval walking training seems to provide some better beneficial effects on blood sugar regulation compared with continuous paced walking. So research has shown that, for example, your blood sugar levels in people with type 2 diabetes tend to be much lower for several hours after you finish the exercise session compared with if you've just done a continuous paced walk, and then obviously compared with doing no exercise at all. Those effects will typically last up to about 24 to 48 hours. So I guess the key thing is, the key message from that is that this has to be something that is performed on a regular basis. So we'd be saying sort of 3 to 4 sessions a week to maintain those beneficial effects. And then if you do maintain that kind of frequency of exercise and do it for a longer period of time, over a period of sort of several weeks, then there's also some research showing that you will tend to see better improvements in other important aspects of fitness, so cardiovascular fitness, better overall blood sugar control. You tend to lose more body fat as well if you walk in that sort of interval walking manner compared with just continuous paced walking. So yeah, it seems like just mixing up the pace of your walk during the same session seems to result in some much better health benefits compared to if you just walk at a continuous pace, for example.
Does this mean people need to embark on intense exercise?
This type of exercise, we're literally just talking about alternating periods of fairly slow-paced walking with periods of more brisk-paced walking. So, again, that's relative to your individual baseline fitness. So we're talking here about walking, for example, during the slower-paced intervals. In the research studies, people walked at around 3.5 kilometres per hour, so that would be a fairly slow-paced walk during the lower intensity intervals, and then getting up to between sort of 5.5 and 6 kilometres an hour during the faster-paced intervals. And that essentially amounts to walking just with a bit more purpose and walking more briskly. And then in terms of guiding that, to make sure you're kind of doing it correctly, then you know, you can guide it based on your sort of perception of effort. It's quite a nice, easy way to guide your exercise intensity. So during the slower paced intervals, then the exercise should feel light. So sort of between 2 or 3 out of 10 on an effort scale. And then during the faster paced intervals, you're aiming for it to feel sort of somewhat hard to hard during the faster paced intervals. So again, maybe aiming for between a 4 and a 5 out of 10 on an effort scale. So we're really not talking about something that's very intense here. We're just talking about relatively higher intensity exercise compared with if you were just walking at your normal pace. And we're only talking about doing that for alternating sort of periods of 2 or 3 minutes. So for 2 or 3 minutes, you walk at a slower pace, and then for 2 or 3 minutes, you walk at a faster pace, and just alternate that out during the same session.
So how long should someone aim to be walking for? And what about very busy people? Is there a good way for them to include this type of exercise into their daily routine?
Sure. So I think the thing to point out is that this type of exercise isn't designed to be time efficient. So that's one of the main aims of high intensity interval training in general. This isn't aiming to achieve that. So the overall time you spend walking should be the same as if you were just going to go for a walk at a continuous speed. So the recommendations for kind of walking exercise or moderate intensity exercise would be around 30 to 60 minutes. So if you're doing an interval walk, then you should be aiming for a similar duration, so 30 to 60 minutes. It's just that you are walking or alternating your pace within that. And then the research would suggest that you'll get some better health benefits by doing that compared with if you just did continuous paced walking. And then I think you said, so in terms of if you're very busy and you don't have time to fit that duration of exercise in, then there's some really nice recent research showing that you can basically cut up that exercise session into more manageable chunks. So, for example, if you just split it up to 3 shorter 10-minute walks throughout the day, you could either do that as a continuous pace walk, or if you wanted to do as an interval walking session, then maybe 4 to 5 sort of 1-minute intervals of of faster walking. And if you do that prior to each meal, for example, then that's also a very effective strategy for lowering your blood sugar levels when you have that meal containing some carbohydrate.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
Another fascinating project is an extreme physical challenge in the United States aimed primarily at people with type 1. Patrick Mertz told me about the Diabetes Family Connection Challenge to climb 50 peaks in 50 days. So it's not only about staying well, but also staying positive. He told me how the project is helping to build confidence and optimism within people living with diabetes.
About a year ago, I did a pretty long backpacking trip in California called the John Muir Trail. And once I got off that trail, I was on a pretty big high. And I had reached out to Michael, who had also completed the hike several years prior. And I thought that this, using the outdoors as a classroom, would be a really awesome way to get people from the type 1 community involved and outside. And Michael and I kind of brainstormed on what could be a very big project that we could do that would get people from across the United States outdoors and kind of involved in a fun project. And there is an adventurer called Colin O'Brady who set the world record for achieving the highest summit in each of the 50 states. And he had just done it about a year prior and did it in just a remarkable amount of time. But we thought that this could be a challenge that we could replicate and then also involve people from across the United States that were affected by diabetes. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, the Cliff Notes version of how we brainstormed the project and kind of brought it to fruition.
And no one with type 1's ever achieved this before?
No one with type 1 has done it before. In fact, less than about 275 people have ever done it in the world. And we are within the top 4 to do it in the fastest amount of time.
Amazing, amazing. So can you just talk a little bit about your original diagnosis, bit of background for your type 1?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was 9 years old when I was diagnosed, and I had kind of the typical symptoms where I was just constantly thirsty. I could never drink enough fluids. I started wetting the bed again. My grandfather was actually living with type 1 as well. Mm. So my mom was always kind of had it on her radar that this could be something that could potentially affect our family. So she actually caught my symptoms pretty early on. I wasn't very far into ketoacidosis or anything like that. So I was brought to my pediatrician, and my pediatrician kind of had the wherewithal to check for type 1, and sure enough, my glucose levels were so out of range that I was admitted to the hospital. I spent about a week in the hospital where I got the crash course, if you will, making sure that I was capable of giving my own insulin injections. And at the time, it was NPH and regular insulins. So just kind of, I was put on a sliding scale at the hospital, and then we were kind of on our own in terms of figuring it out from there.
Did you know anybody, well, apart from grandfather, did you have any support at all at the time?
I did not. So this was something that was brand new to me. There was no one at my school. There was no one in my friend group or kind of in my immediate community that I knew that was living with type 1. I got plugged into a really instrumental endocrinologist pretty early on into my journey with diabetes, who was fairly adamant about getting me involved with diabetes camps. Yeah. So when I was 9 years old, I attended my first diabetes camp, and I'm now 31 years old, and I run a nonprofit that puts on diabetes camps. So it was something that, you know, was very impactful for me then, and now I'm at a stage where I feel the need to kind of pay it forward and provide those experiences to other kids that are facing the challenges of diabetes.
Fantastic. And I noticed that in your initial blog about the 50-50 project, you mentioned lows, ketones and acute mountain sickness. Can you just talk about how you managed things like hypos and hypers and detecting ketones during the climbs?
Sure. So, you know, I think this probably affected me the most on our very first climb, which also happened to be our most strenuous climb. So our first summit was Denali, which was formerly called Mount McKinley, which is one of the tallest seven summits in the world. And it takes about 9 days to even reach the summit. Well, it took us 9 days. It takes most people about 21 days to reach the summit of McKinley. And because the altitude is so high, there's all sorts of things that are going on physiologically with your body that just makes, you know, even if you didn't have diabetes, it would make it very challenging. But with diabetes, that added stress on the body really made my blood sugars do all sorts of wonky things. One of the things that we were really fortunate to have in our toolkit was Michael and I both wore Dexcom continuous glucose monitors. And then the CGMs actually spoke with our insulin pumps. So we also wore Tandem T-Slim X2s. So that communication really kind of helped prevent some of the bigger issues, but you know, even having this top of the line technology in our toolkits, I still was affected by ketones, and I think that was secondary more towards the altitude than it was something that could be preventable by just, you know, kind of keeping constant eye on where my CGM trends were heading.
So how did you cope then with those ketones?
Yeah, so what I would typically do, and you know, I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but I would give an injection at that point. So I would give an injection for about 1.5 times what I would usually give for a correction. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just kind of following typical ketone protocol where I would just, you know, I was already drinking a lot of fluids, but I did everything I could to kind of flush those out of my system because, you know, when, not that they were large ketones by any stretch, but when I had those ketones, the last thing I wanted to do was continue exercising. So I, you know, just did everything I could to get my blood sugars back into range.
Did that get easier the more summits you achieved, or was it just something, just a real balancing act all the time?
Yeah, so, you know, Denali, I would say, was kind of an expedition within itself. One of the things that did make it a little bit easier is the longer you're on the mountain at that altitude, your body will begin to acclimate to the elevation, which then makes everything a little bit easier. And the effects of your body acclimating to elevation has a duration of about 14 days. So anytime we kind of hit higher elevations or other elevations post Denali, it was a little bit easier each time. So, I would say kind of the longer we were at it, the exhaustion may be increased, but in terms of kind of the physiological effects, it got a little bit easier on the body.
And you find that tech has really helped. Are you still using a pump and your Dexcom, or was that just something you did for the climbs?
No, I still wear it. So, you know, one of the things that we're pretty adamant about kind of letting the community know is that the technology that's available today really does make expeditions and life in the backcountry a lot safer and a lot more attainable for people that are living with type 1. Just having constant access to your blood glucose levels is really a game changer. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't say that an expedition like this would be impossible, but I would say it'd be a lot more challenging. And then, you know, just having access to this technology in the front country, there's still, you know, I'm not going to lie and say that I've got perfect, you know, blood glucose all the time, but just having access to that information really makes diabetes a whole lot easier to manage.
Patrick Mertz.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, a monthly podcast from DRWF. It's been a busy couple of months for the DRWF team, with two major diabetes wellness days in the Midlands and the north of England. I caught up with a couple of delegates in Kenilworth near Birmingham to discover how helpful they had found the event.
My name's Claire Rudge, and I'm from Redditch.
Lovely, Claire. Is this your first time at a diabetes wellness event?
Yes, it's the first time I've been. I found out about it on Facebook, I think it was.
Fantastic, good to know. What made you want to come today?
I was diagnosed with diabetes type 2 about 18 months, 2 years ago. You don't really get an awful lot of information. And being a wellness day as well, I was hoping to find things that would be useful for me to do that, stay well before a cure.
Exactly. What have you found most useful from today?
I found the question and answer thing that we had first really useful. Was listening to ideas that other people have got and the questions that they've got as well, some that you probably hadn't even thought of yourself, or you'd thought of but didn't want to ask. He answered my question really well, because I asked about the level for type 2 diabetes, and there's not really one. You don't have to sort of worry too much, but just take care. So I found that really helpful, and that sort of helps to settle you down a little bit as well, because you have these worries: am I doing the right thing, am I doing the wrong thing, should I be doing this? You don't know really, because there's not many practices give you much information, I'm afraid.
Have you been chatting to the other people here as well? Do you find that's useful?
Yeah, I've had a chat with a few people, and it is useful, because I know that it's a bit of a cliche, you know, you're not on your own and other people are feeling that sort of thing as well. And the reason about the wellness, so I've got other health issues, so then it's trying to pick out, is it this, is it that, what is it? So it was good listening to some people and how diabetes is affecting them, because obviously everybody's different, so it's good.
Excellent. Do you think you'll come again?
I'd definitely come again, yeah, and I'm really looking forward to the mindfulness thing this afternoon as well.
Brilliant, lovely, thank you very much indeed.
Frank Steinheimer.
And where are you from, Frank?
Stratford-upon-Avon.
And what brought you here today?
I've been diabetic now for 39 years, and I'm always trying to find out what the latest is, and go to these events to see some of the industry and see some other like-minded diabetics to see what the latest is in the market and how to improve things.
Type 1 or type 2?
Type 1.
So what sort of regime are you on?
I'm on a basal bolus regime. And which works quite well, actually.
Yeah. And any complications that you've experienced?
I used to have hypos quite a few times when I was younger. Then you get picked up by the ambulance and quite severe. So fortunately, I've managed that better now to recognise the symptoms. And with the latest now, with the CGM systems and things, you get the alarms. And you don't have to worry about that anymore.
So what are you wearing in terms of tech?
I've got a Freestyle Libre, and we just self-funded for a year, and yeah. Now finally got on prescription.
Fantastic. What a difference has that made to your diabetes control?
It's a lot better. I can see so much more now what's happening. I'm very unpredictable. One day is not like the other. I'm driving a lot, so where you had to finger prick 10 times a day, and every time you jump in the car, and now you can just scan and see where you are, is it going up or down, makes a huge difference.
Fantastic. Why? What kind of things have you got from today's Diabetes Wellness Day in Midlands?
I think there was a lot of asked the question in the very interactive discussion group, which I really enjoyed, just to see how much more tech is going to be developed and coming out in the next year or two. And how much it's going back into, well, how many people are similar interested in that technology, really.
It's good to know.
Yeah.
All right, well, hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Definitely.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
I'll have a full report from the Diabetes Day North in Hartlepool in our next podcast. There's a new season of events in 2020. More details on the website at drwf.org.uk. While you're there, you may like to sign up to our monthly newsletter from just £8 a year, or make a donation. Please include the gift aid if you are eligible. For the more energetic, there are some great activities and events coming up to raise funding for us through sponsorship. Please get in touch for more details, fundraising ideas, or to ask for support on an event in which you are already participating. Call our office on 02392 637 808. That's 02392 637 808. Standard call rates apply.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, a monthly podcast from DRWF. Research is an important part of DRWF's work and includes a wide-ranging portfolio of fascinating projects that have huge potential. Dr. Eleanor Kennedy is our research manager, and I asked her to give some insights into the types of research we're currently supporting.
The first research grant was funded by DRWF, I think that was back in about 1999. The organisation's actually committed more than £12 million to diabetes research in the UK and also as part of the wider international diabetes wellness network around the world.
So people may not be aware of this research funding element to the work of the charity. What is the current research programme at DRWF designed to support?
It does historically have a focus on islet cell transplantation, which I can come back to, but it now funds much broader than that. It's not just islet cell transplantation. It funds across the type 1 and the type 2 research portfolio.
How does the charity choose which projects to fund?
We have a real gold standard way of ensuring that we fund the really the best project. And to do that, we have in the UK, we have external peer review, which means that every time a grant comes in, I send it out. Part of my role is to read it and to send it out to 4, 5, sometimes 6 international peer review experts, people who are key opinion leaders in the field that the particular project is in, to garner their thoughts and their questions as to whether this particular piece of research is good, will it add to the jigsaw. And then we take all of those comments back and we have a sort of second layer of debate and decision, which revolves around the research advisory board that we have. And there we have, again, international key opinion leaders, real thought leaders from the UK who take on board all the different comments that we've received on the grants. And they make the really difficult decision, which is that we only have a set amount of money. We can't, unfortunately, fund everything. So we need to take the comments of the board and the external peer review and add those together and decide which of the grants that we've got we'll be able to fund.
Excellent. So do you have any examples of DRWF-funded research you'd like to share with us?
Yes, I do. There are lots of different pieces of DRWF-funded research that I'm really proud that DRWF has funded over the years. And some of those come from the pump priming. Some of those are small amounts of research, small amounts of money that have really catalysed a project. And we've funded across the complications range. So we've funded some very innovative work in diabetic retinopathy, cardiovascular disease, and also on more basic side in stem cells and in beta cell biology, beta cells being the little cells in the pancreas that are absolutely vital for diabetes because they're the only cell in the body that produces insulin, which is the hormone that is really at the centre of all of this research. So those kinds of little bits of research are great because then when we receive a final report, we see that the person has gone on to get more funding from another agency, has published papers that DRWF is acknowledged on. And of course, our fellowships are always great because then we have somebody who is working on DRWF money for about 3 years. And we funded work into stem cells. We funded work in islet cell transplantation. We funded work on bariatric surgery, which is the type of metabolic surgery that people who are obese or morbidly obese may be able to receive on the NHS and which puts diabetes, type 2 diabetes, essentially into remission. So there's lots of lovely examples of that. And again, I would recommend people go to the DRWF website because we do keep up to date with a lot of the communications that we have there. We put up research stories there all the time. And there's video from some site visits that we've done speaking to DRWF-funded researchers, and lots of stories of research projects that we've funded where the researcher has been very grateful and has helped us to write a piece about their work. So again, I would recommend people go there to find out a little bit more about what we do. I think DRWF does make a difference to researchers. Without putting too fine a point on it, as a researcher myself, any funding agency is going to make a difference to the life of a researcher, because we live or die by getting grants, because otherwise we can't do the research. And if we can't do the research, then we're never going to find a cure. What makes DRWF stand a little apart from other researchers, I feel, is the close relationship that we have with our researchers. We're a relatively small charity, but that doesn't mean that we can't have a big impact. And it also means that I have the great pleasure of being able to go around our sites and talk to the researchers that are funded by us. And I think that connection is quite unique. And from the feedback that I've received, it's also very well received. So I do think that DRWF, not just the funding makes a difference to researchers, but we're giving them a platform to talk to me as the research manager, but also talk to all the supporters of DRWF, because as I said, we actually publish their research stories and put them on our website.
Excellent. Diabetes research is a global effort, and you've recently returned from the European Association for the Study of Diabetes, EASD, conference, and you've blogged about the event on the DRWF website, which people can go and read. Can you share any highlights from the event?
The EASD conference, I think, is one of the best ones in the world. I adore EASD. I think it's a fantastic conference. It's huge. There are about 15,000 people in Barcelona this year. And it covers everything. So you cover everything from the most basic of basic research to very much translational and epidemiological research, and to patient education research. So things that are instantly implementable in practice to things that will take many, many years to come to fruition. But I think this year there were a lot of very good what they call named lectures. So there are several sort of prize named lectures, and I think they were excellent. And one of the named lecturers this year, Professor Timo Wotan-Tukoski, actually used to sit on our sister organisation, the Diabetes Wellness Network in Sweden, used to sit on the research advisory board there. So that was a real that was really lovely to see somebody that I've worked closely with being rewarded for really quite outstanding work in the field of stem cells. But I think the other thing that people should be really aware of is that the number of clinical trials that are reporting now is at a level that is unprecedented. I've never seen so many clinical trials being reported. And each clinical trial that reports, again, it's very implementable into practice. These are results that will affect people with diabetes. It will affect their management and their treatment within the next few months or years. So this is it's lovely to see these results coming out. And in large part, these results are very positive. So the drugs that are currently in the diabetes armamentarium are, they're really excellent drugs, and we're now showing that quite a lot of them are going to be of use in people that maybe don't have type 2 diabetes. There's one class of drug, the SGLT2 inhibitors, which have been shown to be incredibly useful in people with type 2 diabetes. They allow weight loss, they allow better management of diabetes. So they have an excellent safety profile. But now they're also showing that they might be useful in people who just have problems with their kidneys and just have problems with cardiovascular system. So the drugs that have been piloted and have been set out to help people with diabetes are now seeing use in a much wider audience. And of course, that has to be of benefit to everybody.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
One of the research projects is My Diabetes, being conducted by Dr. Shivani Misra, a consultant in metabolic medicine and an honorary research fellow at the Faculty of Medicine in the Department of Metabolism, Digestion and Reproduction at Imperial College London.
The My Diabetes study was really something that I came up with the idea for just before I applied for funding for my PhD from the DRWF. And I was interested in looking for a rare form of diabetes called MODY, which stands for maturity onset diabetes of the young, in people from minority ethnic groups. And until I sort of designed this project, there were very few reports of MODY in people of South Asian ethnicity or African Caribbean ethnicity. And in fact, someone had looked about 10 years before to see how many cases there were in the UK, and it just seemed really underrepresented. So I went about setting up a study to systematically look for MODY by recruiting people who had been diagnosed with different types of diabetes at a young age and then systematically screening them for MODY. And that's really the crux of that study.
So you've probably already answered this, but why was the study so important? What did you discover?
Yeah, so I think it addressed a really key knowledge gap. So up until we had set up the My Diabetes study, there were lots of reports about MODY. And MODY, it's a tricky condition to diagnose because it's hidden amongst the sea of type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So you have to be really astute to pick out the MODY cases. And that's in every ethnic group. So we were really addressing a key knowledge gap in South Asians and African Caribbeans. And at a time when there was increasing recognition of the high frequency of diabetes in these ethnic groups, and type 2 diabetes is just so much more common in people from minority ethnic groups. So I think it was an important study because it focused attention on these understudied ethnic groups, but also raised awareness amongst healthcare professionals about MODY and make people ask the question, well, I've got a young person of South Asian ethnicity. I think it's probably type 2, but could it be MODY? People weren't asking that latter question. And I think I'd like to think, you know, the study's still continuing, but I'd like to think that people are more aware and thinking about that question now.
So, again, you've probably touched on this, but just explain why that misdiagnosis was taking place. And maybe if you kind of what maturity onset diabetes of the young MODY is.
Yes, I haven't said that, have I? So MODY is a genetic form of diabetes. So when we talk about type 1 and type 2 diabetes, which represent the most frequent forms of diabetes, people don't have a mutation or a spelling mistake in their DNA that leads to type 2 or type 1 diabetes. Whereas in MODY, people have a spelling mistake in the coding of their DNA, which means that no matter what they do, they will develop diabetes. And there's a variety of genes that can cause MODY, and collectively you sort of lump them all together and call them MODY. Now, it's really important to diagnose MODY because the treatment is different to type 1 or type 2 diabetes. And if people are not on the correct treatment, they might not have great control of their diabetes. So it's very important to make the diagnosis. The problem is, and as you said, I did allude to this, MODY cases are hidden amongst the large number of type 1 and even larger number of type 2 diabetes cases. So the traditional features that identify MODY cases overlap a lot between type 1 and type 2. And there's been some wonderful research in the past that has shown that, you know, you're more likely to pick up cases of MODY if you're thinking about it. But if you never ask the question, could this person have MODY? You're not going to be able to detect it. So really the issue arises because the clinical features of MODY overlap so much with type 2 and type 1 diabetes.
How was the My Diabetes study organised? Is it still running?
Yes, it's definitely still running. So, as mentioned, the DRWF very kindly funded my PhD, which was so important to get the study set up. And I'd always planned to recruit around 800 people from white European and South Asian ethnic groups. So, you know, I was never going to be able to do that just by recruiting at Imperial College. And so we applied to have the study adopted by the NIHR Clinical Research Network, which is this fantastic network that enables research to be taken up by other centres. And at its peak, the My Diabetes study was and actually is still recruiting at around 40 sites. Hospital sites in England. So with everyone, one of these sites recruiting people diagnosed before the age of 30 years, we've been able to get quite large numbers. And we're now, you know, coming towards the end of the study. It's going to end in the next few years. But we do have some fantastic data coming through. But it's only really with the support of the Clinical Research Network that we've been able to reach such large numbers.
So again, I think you might have already answered this, but are healthcare professionals missing cases of MODY in South Asian and African Caribbean individuals, and how has your research helped to change it?
Yes, definitely. So I can only comment on interim analyses because, as I've mentioned, we've not finished the study yet. But in interim analyses, we have identified misdiagnosed cases of MODY in white and South Asian and some African Caribbean individuals. So these are people where the clinician or the healthcare professional thought it's type 1 or it's type 2, but actually we've found that they have MODY, and we've also shown that they a proportion of them were on the wrong treatment. What's interesting at the moment from our interim analysis is that the detection rate for MODY is lower in the South Asians group, and I think that goes back to what we were saying before about there being more type 2 diabetes occurring at young age and it being difficult to pick the MODY cases out. And I think once we write these data up for publication and start presenting it at conferences, the word will get out to healthcare professionals. But you know, even during my PhD, thanks to some of the engagement work that I did with the DRWF at various conferences, you know, people are getting that message. And I think it's only through, you know, speaking at conferences and doing educational activities with GPs and other healthcare professionals that we'll be able to get this message out.
Next time, I'll have a special report from our Diabetes Wellness Day North in Hartlepool and discovering more about a new app available through the NHS in some parts of the country. Robbie Puddick, registered nutritionist and the NHS lead for Our Path.
We provide educational articles that are released daily on the app. You also have the support of a registered dietitian, a registered nutritionist as your health coach, and they're on hand to analyse your food diaries, help you set goals and just be there as a support system essentially. So then obviously you can track your weight and activity through our technology, so through our scales and activity tracker if you choose to have them as well.
It will be our bumper Christmas and New Year edition, so we'll also be reviewing the major stories of 2019, contemplating the trends of the past decade and projections for the next. This is Claire Levy from Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. Our thanks to all the people who talked to me this month, and also to you for listening. I'm looking forward to joining you again in our next edition of Living with Diabetes.
Living with Diabetes is a Blue Aurora Media production for DRWF. Copyright 2019. Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. All rights reserved.